Hello, I'm Sam, and this is Pilgrim Pit Stop. It's a podcast about following Jesus through life's highs and lows. And there's a new episode every other Friday. So I would really love it if you hit subscribe and tell your friends about it as well, if you enjoy what you hear. Here's a little clip of what's coming up today.
The reality is that, like, Jesus actually is not at war with our hearts. He never has been. He has been at war for our hearts.
All right, let's go. Hello, welcome back to Pilgrim Pit Stop. You're about to hear a conversation that I recorded on February the 11th, 2021. Just a heads up, there is discussion in this conversation of suicide. So just want to flag that up at the start of the episode. But without further ado, here is that conversation with Ashley Anderson. It's my great pleasure to now be joined by Ashley Anderson, who is the community's groups pastor at Church of the City, New York. Ashley, welcome to the podcast.
Sam, thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
It's an honor to have you. Honestly, I heard you speak on the Church of the City, New York podcast, which I try to listen to every week. And your message back in November on Matthew 5:8, blessed are the pure in heart, was just so moving. And I'm really excited to kind of dig into some of the stuff that you were talking about in that message. But I was wondering if we could kind of start, I guess, at the beginning and talk about, you know, what role, if any, Christianity had as you were growing up. I'd be fascinated to hear from your point of view.
I'm so happy to share. I was one of those people that really grew up with, like, almost no framework for faith. I'm originally from California, and if you have any context or stereotypes for, like, what that is, that's just about right. Like, my parents were, like, very liberal, very hippie, very my dad just was like, he is such a brilliant man and such a strong atheist, at least in my childhood, and had, like, a real distrust for, like, any type of organized power, particularly organized religion. And so I just kind of was a California kid in that way. So between my parents, my mom was probably a little bit more open to faith. She, I might call, like, more agnostic. She was pretty comfortable with the idea of God, but she had no real, like, pursuit of who that God was in her life. I can remember there being a Bible in our house growing up, and it truly was, like, in my mind, just like a filing folder. It's literally where she kept my birth certificate, and that's all it was. And so, like, I had no real concept or curiosity to, like, what was actually in that book. None of that, like, really played itself out in our family. And so, you know, in the way God works, there were different people that came in and out of my life through my childhood and my, like, young adult years who were people of faith. And there was maybe, like, a stint in the third grade where a friend's grandma was taking me to a Methodist church. And now in hindsight, I was like, well, that was such a weird part of my life. So the way that, like, God kind of wove some narratives into my life, they gave me some idea of, like, what faith could be was, like, obviously his faithfulness. But it was always a little bit more far away. So mm-hmm. in my family, in my home, like, spirituality just really wasn't something we ever discussed or practiced. It wasn't until later in life, until pretty much the end of college, that I really found faith and found God, and that kind of shook up my whole world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's a line in your sermon that really sort of stood out to me, and I wrote it down, which I just, it was such a kind of powerful line, which was, so this is sort of fast forwarding in your story now, but I'd been an adult for all of 3 months and I'd already burned my life to the ground. So what kind of led you to that point, and what had happened in the interim years to kind of make you feel that way?
Yeah, I had a pretty complicated childhood. And so I think, like many people in life, I had set like my 18th birthday and graduating high school and going to college as this threshold of like, if I can cross it, then I will have made it. Then everything will be fine. Then everything will play out like as I want it to. And that's not the way it played out. So I graduated high school. I moved to Southern California for college and just had like all of these like hopes and ideas of what that time would be like. And I just like slowly but surely hit a roadblock in every single area of my life. And so in my sermon, I talked about some of those like really harsh reality checks of, you know, I was arrested for driving while under the influence while I was 18. And in America, 18 is actually not even the legal drinking age. And so that's like a pretty severe crime to have committed. I had flunked my whole first semester of my freshman year. I'd been caught shoplifting. I had like basically every single area of my life where I thought there could be kind of a new chapter, I had ripped it apart. And so it was like a real low. Like I think that I had hit different lows in my life that I thought this, you know, this could be rock bottom. But that was like really it. It was like further than I thought I would fall.
And then tell me about the kind of the weeks leading up to Christmas of your freshman year, which I think was a very significant time for you.
Yeah, so that's kind of when a lot of that played out. And I don't know if it was like the imminence of the holidays around the corner or like the turning of a new year or just the reality of like, you know, I had stumbled in so many ways, but it became this real reckoning in my spirit of like, do I want to keep doing this actually? Like, can I make good of this? Can I turn this around? And I think my like resounding response from my heart was like, no, I don't think so. And so in those weeks, I had started actually like planning and had made a decision to end my life. And it felt so like natural at the time. It felt like very logical. It wasn't even that like emotional after I had like, you know, thought through all of the reasons why. And so I had just kind of debated like, okay, do I do this before Christmas or after Christmas? If it's like before Christmas, it will ruin everybody's holiday. If it's after Christmas, people will buy me things and I will have never used them. And so it was like really down to trying to find the polite time to end my life, which, you know, now sounds so wild. But yeah, that's kind of where those weeks had led me. I had just gotten to the end of the road and made a real decision of like, I think this is the only way out.
And then I think during that time, was it that someone took you to church? Can you tell us a little bit about that kind of that moment and what that felt like in the moment, and maybe your reflections on it now, looking back kind of in retrospect, what that actually meant that time?
Yeah, I didn't have a ton of time in the sermon that I shared to unpack this piece. I'm glad you asked, because, you know, we can paint broad brush strokes and say, like, I got invited to church and everything was different, which is true eventually.
Yeah.
So in those weeks leading up to Christmas, I had a neighbor who was a friend of mine. And, you know, when I had gotten arrested, I'd lost my license. And so he was doing really practical things like driving me to work and driving me to school. And he invited me to church, and I like truly probably wouldn't have said yes at any other time, but I had nothing to lose. And I had figured like, you know, if I am going to any type of afterlife, I should probably like check out the possibilities, of, like what I might be seeing on the other side of this. And so I went one Sunday, like not thinking much of it. And then really week to week, it wasn't like, am I going to give my whole life to this or not? It was really just like, can I come back one more Sunday? I guess so. And so I did that for a long time. I am actually pretty skeptical as a person, generally, you know, the inheritance of my father. And I'm pretty stubborn. And so I went to church just about every Sunday for 2 years before I decided intellectually of like, you know, I thought I could prove this wrong, but I actually can't. This feels like the truest thing I've ever heard. And so that was the moment where I was like, you know, I think Jesus really is who he says he is. So it changed my mind. But honestly, that didn't even like change my heart right away. So it literally took another 2 years where I was just kind of living half in, half out before I was really sure that like, not only is Jesus who he says he is, but he's actually worth me like living for. He's worth me giving my whole life to. He's worth me like actually changing my life. And so it was actually January 2nd of 2011. A big part of that transformation for me was getting sober. And so I decided that day that I would stop drinking for a year, which seemed like unreasonable to all of my friends, to all of my community. And it was so hard in the beginning. I actually like would have dreams that I forgot or I accidentally drank or somebody gave me something and it was alcohol and I didn't know. I would like wake up sweating and shaking. And I didn't know I like really, really had a problem until I really, really tried to stop. And I got through the end of that year by God's grace. And at the end of that year, decided it was for life. And so this past January 2nd, I actually celebrated 10 years of sobriety.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And 10 years of like really walking with God.
Yeah. And in those 10 years, what have you learned about discipleship to Jesus? What does that look like on a practical level for you?
I would say like what was funny is I really am kind of an all-in or all-out person. And so literally January of 2011, I just like did everything I could think to do with my body. Like everything I could sign up for, I did. So I started going to a small group. I signed up for a missions trip. I really started like sitting at the front row of church. I, you know, was working out my sobriety. I just like did all the things I could think to do. And really that changed a lot of my life. Because I started meeting Christian friends in my small group, all of a sudden I'm on the mission field and I have to like believe that this is true, not just for me, but for somebody else and like actually share the gospel and have encounters where I really rely on God. And so I don't know that that would be my like recommended discipleship path of just like, do all those things. But it really did change a lot for me. And because I had lived so many years before that, I knew I knew that this was like the best way and there was no turning back. And so I would say pretty early, I started a lot of those like discipleship rhythms of like reading the word and being in community and finding ways to build the kingdom and the church. And the latter half of the 10 years has been working all of those things that were in my hands and in my mind into my heart. I think so much of honestly, it was a freedom in the beginning of like, I can actually do what's right. My whole life, I've been trying to do what's right and I have not done it. But now I can actually make a choice and do the right thing. So if I'm ever given a chance to do the right thing or the wrong thing, I'm going to choose the right thing. And that was right enough for a lot of those years. But I think in the more recent years, I've been really trying to wrestle this stuff into my heart and get to the motivation behind why I do what I do, or if I really have like the right heart behind the right action. And so practically what that looks like is it's honestly just a lot of question asking, because on the outside, it all looks good. It all looks the same. But on the inside, I'm trying to ask myself like, why do you want to do that service thing? Why do you want to do that prayer opportunity? Why? Like, so just asking a lot of like why questions, a lot of reflection, self-examination, prayer.
Talk a lot about the heart and kind of purity of heart, and I guess the key text is Matthew 5:8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. What do you think is the invitation of that to us as followers of Christ?
Yeah. It's like an invitation to love God. And I don't know that I've like really understood that for most of my Christian life. I think in my imagination, it almost seems like I envision like a person and his dog, like a master and his dog of like, if you do this trick, then you get this treat. If you're pure in heart, then you will see God. It's kind of this like sacrifice and reward in my mind. But I think the reality that I'm awakening to is like, that's not it at all. That it's like God who's saying like, do you want to see me? Amazing. I want you to see me, but your eyes aren't strong enough. So here, let me give you these glasses. Let me give you these lenses by which you can actually see me through. And so I think that's the journey of the invitation is figuring out like, how do we actually behold the God who is always around us? Behold the God who is always there, the God who is always near, but what are the right lenses by which we can actually see him? And what more beautiful an invitation? Like there are very few things that are worth more than like being able to actually see God.
What do you think are some of the things that kind of prevent us maybe from fully embracing that invitation and the glory of that invitation?
Yes, I think maybe similar to what I felt in the beginning of my faith walk is we have this false dichotomy of there's right and there's wrong. And so I think that most of us are trying to do that. We're trying to do what's right and avoid what's wrong. But I think the real challenges are there actually are many more pitfalls on the path to purity, on the path to righteousness that are kind of catching us off guard. So we can do what's right, but we can actually still fall into so many of these pitfalls along the way. Let me just highlight three that I think are like three of the biggest stumbling blocks that we can fall into on the path to purity. The first is that we can actually want the right thing, but for the wrong reasons. So similar to, you know, most of my Christian life, you get on the outside, have it all together, on the outside, be doing the right things, but for the absolute wrong reason. So you can be in, you know, on the street serving the homeless. You can be handing out brochures at church. You can be like the first one down to the altar at the end of a worship service, but that can be happening for all the wrong reasons. And at its best, what that is it's just behavior modification. It's saying like, I know the right thing to do. And so whatever is in my heart, whatever I want, I'm just going to disregard that and do just the right thing to do. Which, you know, in some ways is the beginning stages of trying to purify our hearts, but we can't operate out of that for our whole Christian lives. So at its best, it's behavior modification. At its worst, it's hypocrisy. It's, you know, doing all the right things that are visible, but having a secret interior life that's less visible and less pure. And so that's the first trap is like, we want to do the right things, but for the wrong reason. Another trap that I think we can fall into is that we can just pretend like we actually have no desire. So Soren Kierkegaard, he kind of frames purity of heart, I think, better than anybody else. He says, purity of heart is to will one thing. It's just to will God and his goodness. And so I would say like so many of us just pretend like we will nothing. And we think that's purity, just to repress all of our wills and our desires. So we experience thoughts and temptations that we can't even admit to ourselves, yet alone others. And instead of addressing those things head on, we try to deal with in the dark what can truly only be overcome in the light. And so we're not inviting in the right amount of accountability or support to really like tackle these things and wrestle them to the ground. So I would say the second trap is we just pretend that we will nothing. That's just repression. The third thing is that we can will the right thing among many things. So if purity of heart is to will one thing, I think so many of us feel secure as long as one of the things we will is the right thing. But we still have so many competing intentions and desires, and truly that's idolatry. Like we want to see God's kingdom come, but we don't only want to see God's kingdom come. We also want a nice apartment. We want our kids to go to a great school. We want that promotion at work. We want more visibility, you know, on whatever like sphere of influence we have. We want the right thing, but we want it among many things. And That's not what Jesus is asking for. He's not asking to be the first on our list of many priorities. He's literally asking to be the center of every priority we have. And I think so many of us settle for just short of that. We're so happy to put God first. We feel so proud of putting God first. But like, really, he doesn't want to be first. He wants to be central.
Mm. That's a great framework. That's really, really helpful. And I think when a lot of people hear this word purity, they'll kind of alarm bells will go off in their minds, because they'll be thinking of things like, you know, the purity culture movement from the 1990s and 2000s. And, you know, a lot of that has caused a huge amount of damage, actually, to a lot of different people for a number of reasons. How does this differ, what we're talking about now, to all of that stuff, in your opinion?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't grow up in the church. And so I came to context on a lot of this later in life, but I have friends that are still dealing with the fallout of, you know, middle school purity talks that told them that they were like a tissue that once it's used is to be thrown away, or they were like a lollipop that, you know, once somebody licks it, nobody really wants to lick it again, or they were like a piece of tape that if you stuck it to too many things, it actually lost its stickiness, that it couldn't be used anymore. And I think that that's resonant around culture around the world. There's a woman, her name is Linda K. Klein, and she wrote a book called Pure. You know, it's an interesting read. I don't know that she would still call herself a Christian. I think that this was a big part of her reckoning with her spirituality, and unfortunately, like, pushed her away from the church. But some of the things she has to say are really telling. She had said that she reconnected with some of her middle school, like, youth group friends in their adulthood, and that so many of them were actually dealing with physical symptoms that mimicked PTSD. Like, they had cold sweats, they had nightmares, they had anxiety. And she had said, like, we are dealing with the side effects of men who had gone to war. And her conclusion is that, like, actually, we have gone to war. We've gone to war with ourselves, with our hearts, with our bodies, all in the name of God. That just breaks my heart, because that's not it, right? Like, we can't imagine that this is the abundant life that God is calling us to. And we can't imagine this is something that Jesus would call blessed. That doesn't sound very blessed. And so that really does beg the question of, like, then what was Jesus talking about? Why is it blessed to be impure in heart? Because that, like, doesn't sound very blessed. And I think the reality is that, like, Jesus actually is not at war with our hearts. He never has been. He has been at war for our hearts. And, like, the cross is proof is this, that there is literally nothing that he wouldn't sacrifice, nothing he wouldn't endure, nothing he wouldn't give up to win our hearts. That this isn't a story of, like, repression or denial of our desires. Really, this story isn't about us at all. It's a story of a good God on a relentless pursuit of the people he loves. There is nothing that he wouldn't do to win our whole hearts. And so it really is. It's like God sees us in bondage and he wants liberation. God sees us in sin and he wants freedom. And he will not hold back in trying to bring us into the light, into freedom, into liberation. And that can feel really messy and it can feel really painful. But I think if we get that piece right, if it's not just about, like, I'm bad, I have to be at war with my own badness, but rather it's like Jesus is actually at war in the world to bring all of his people home. He is, like, at war with powers that are bigger than us, with darkness that extends beyond us, and he's trying to bring us all into the light. Like, we aren't the battleground, like, we are the prize, we're the reward.
It's almost like we've been telling ourselves the wrong story. There's a better story, which is the truth of the gospel. And we I guess we just need to reconnect with that and reframe things and get away from all the kind of baggage, all the stuff that has distorted that story and caused shame and has caused kind of brokenness and, you know, broken relationships and all sorts of things. But there is a better story. And I wonder whether that better story, how you have found sharing that in the New York context, because I don't know New York particularly well myself. I'd be really interested to hear, are people generally fairly open to hearing the gospel or fairly closed when you get into conversations with people?
Great question. And I love this tying back into the bigger story, the better story. And something that I will note maybe as a bridge between those two questions is, there are a few gospel narratives that the church has historically held on to throughout history, most of which we have actually a little bit pushed aside and really hung on to this like sin and atonement story of the gospel of like, you know, I have personally sinned. Jesus died for my personal sins so that I can be saved, which is true. But there are also like multiple narratives, you know, there's bondage to liberation of like, we were all slaves to sin and Jesus actually like died to get the keys to the kingdom back so that we can all be set free. And then there's exiles, the exile narrative where it's like, we are actually all like exiles in the land and that Jesus' death is about bringing us all home. And so I think that some of that plays into people's receptiveness in New York and in this like very postmodern moment that we are in is it's not downplaying the sin and atonement. That's actually a huge part of it. And without that, we will never have like, you know, personal ownership of our own sin and, how that even impacts the people around us. But I think it's pulling in these other narratives as well. The bondage to liberation thing, I think it's like easy for people to understand like, yeah, you're slaves to something. You're all slaves to something. I think we see that playing out in our lives and our workloads, especially in a city like New York. People come here, they work 80-100 hour work weeks. They get that. They get that they are like slaves to something, slaves to Goldman Sachs, slaves to Wall Street, slaves to Broadway, whatever it is. And so I think that there is an opening and a little bit of an awakening, especially in the pandemic, to the good news. I will say generally, like New Yorkers, like the answer is no, like they don't want anything from you. They're a little bit hard. They're a little bit like heads down. They really are here just like grinding it out, for their careers and don't really have a ton of capacity for anything else. But, you know, the world came to a screeching halt last March. And I think it's really shaken stuff up for people. People are asking more questions. People are in the same way. I think they're re-examining, you know, every part of their lives. They're re-examining their spiritual lives. So we've seen, you know, a couple hundred people come into contact with online alpha in the time that we've been in quarantine. And not all of them have gone through it. Some of them have just like signed up and then backed out. But, you know, there is some level of like curiosity. And then I'm even seeing people come into our community groups that have kind of been on the periphery of church for a long time and decided like, you know what, this is the time to actually invest in this. And I think it's a little less intimidating for some to join a Zoom link than it was for them to like walk into a stranger's house or even show up to a church service on a Sunday. A church that I used to be a part of in Washington, D.C., we would, over every service, we would walk the back rows of the theater we met in. We'd pray over the back rows, like the people who are barely in the door, the ones who are like actually like not even comfortable stepping out of like the shadows of the back rows. Who are those people? Let's pray for those people. And I think what going online did is it extended the back rows of the church. Like all of a sudden, there's so much more space for people to hold where they don't have to, you know, walk right into the center of the room right away. They can kind of log online, hang in the back, learn, explore. And, you know, when it feels safe and comfortable, step into a community group. When it feels safe and comfortable, jump into something where they're really engaging or interacting. So that's been really beautiful.
Yeah. I love that. I love that line about extending the back rows. And that's a beautiful picture, actually, of the church and what the church should be, that people should be able to come with their questions and with their, you know, kind of not knowing and wrestling and everything and bring it and not feel kind of ashamed or not feel like they have to have it all worked out. And that's a really beautiful picture of the kingdom. I wonder whether... as you walk with people kind of longer term, whether there's any particular challenges in New York of discipling Christians and discipling people as they grow in their walk with God.
Yes, New York presents many challenges. One of them is, you know, like I shared, the just people come here to build their careers, not necessarily the kingdom. They're the outliers. They're the people who like just really feel like, you know what, God loves people. And there are tons of people in New York. And so I love New York. And this is where I'm doing ministry. But most people come here for 80-hour work weeks. And so it is really hard to figure out, you know, in the margins of a person's life, how do we help them grow spiritually? How do we sustain in the like tiny margins, the 80 hours? And another thing is that it's a really transient place. And so we have people for 6 months, a year, 2 years max sometimes. And so it's really like, how do you walk with somebody well for that amount of time so that we can send them out? And I think that's our spirit of like, you know, we could be a church that focuses on it's a churn and we're always turning over and there's always new people, or we could be a church that really focuses on like, we are a mission sending organization. We can build people up and send them out around the world. So how do we equip them in that time? Is the question of the hour.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what does your role as community groups pastor, what does that involve on a day-to-day basis?
You know, it can be different. Any given day of the week, that's kind of ministry, as I've learned. But we have a network of groups that are still gathering digitally around Manhattan and in the boroughs of New York City. Actually, they're growing more and more diverse now that we're online. We're reaching neighborhoods that we really couldn't reach in person, which has been so powerful. So they gather weekly and they're really there to just care for one another, to like show up for one another in loss and in celebration, to grow with each other into the image of Jesus, and to take care of our city when our city needs us most. And so I pastor those people, and it can look like any, you know, variation from like resourcing them, training them, checking in on them, providing mental health resources, like all the things that come up as you walk with people through a time like this.
I've got two final questions for you, Ashley. One is, what do you have any sort of passages from the Bible, passages from scripture that you find yourself just returning to time and time again? I'm especially interested maybe when the going gets tough. You know, this is a podcast about following Jesus through life's highs and lows. And I'd be really interested if there's any passages that you find yourself returning to in those difficult seasons of life. And then my second question is, what was the last thing you read, watched, or listened that changed your life?
Big questions.
Just small questions on this podcast.
Small questions. But so good. I would say really since the start of the pandemic, I've been going back to a verse. It's a little bit obscure for me. It's 1 Timothy 6:19, and it comes after there's actually this instruction to live, you know, a godly life, to live a life of generosity and good deeds. And it's specifically an exhortation to rich people to actually be generous with their resources. But at the end of it, it says, so that they may take hold of the life that's truly life. And so, you know, kind of in line with this like conversation about purity, it's not about do's and don'ts. It's literally God instructing us in the path to take hold of the life that's truly life. And so at the beginning of quarantine, I just kept asking God of like, okay, what is the life that's truly life? Because I want to feel like I'm actually living. A lot of this doesn't feel like it's truly life. And so if you are here to give me a life abundant, help me do that. Help me take hold of the life that's truly life. And so that's kind of what I turn to when I feel a little disillusioned with the realities of my current life, of just like, okay, what's the real one? What I need to hold on to?
Yeah.
And Sam, that last question, I'll be honest, it's a big one. I, It's a big one. I could wrestle with this to get the exact right answer, but I will have to say, I mean, you might have been watching, there's been like a lot of unrest in the United States this year for a lot of reasons, but we are like right in the thick of a racial reckoning of just the amount of injustice in our nation's history and our nation's present and our nation's DNA and really in our own hearts. And so I've been walking with some people since the summer through a couple of curriculums just to do a little bit more hard examination of our own biases, our own prejudices, and like how we perpetuate systemic injustice. Like, so, you know, systems were built by people and we're people. And so we're trying to work through some of that. Most recently, we've been using Latasha Morrison's Be the Bridge framework. And so I would say reading through, she has a book, but she also has like a manual for becoming a bridge builder step by step. And so I'd say that's the last thing I read that like really changed my life, you know, because it changed my heart. And I hope that it changes my future.
Awesome. Well, Ashley, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time and just amazing to hear from you.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
There we go. That was my conversation with Ashley Anderson from Church of the City, New York. It was brilliant to chat to Ashley, and I really appreciate your time, Ashley, and your wisdom and just all the things that you had to share in that conversation. Bless you. Thank you. Many thanks as well to Johnny Davies for creating the theme music to this podcast, and to Thomas Thorogood for creating the jingles. As always, I really appreciate you listening to this podcast. It's a real blessing to do it, and I'm thankful that you continue to listen. I don't take that lightly, so really, really appreciate you. If you have appreciated this conversation, this interview, this episode today, please do share it with a friend or a family member who you think might appreciate it as well. If you want to support the podcast further, you can click the link in the description and you can buy me a coffee. And that's just a fun way of showing your support for this podcast. Until I speak to you again in 2 weeks' time, I hope you have a really good fortnight. God bless you, and goodbye.